What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
It's Jim Cramer here. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Don't miss a minute of the action.
Good Tuesday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with David Faber and Mike Santoli. Cramer has the morning off. Stocks do look to give back a little of Monday's rally as we get more companies cutting guidance. Snap last night, Abercrombie and Best Buy today. Dollar at a one-month low, and we will hear from Powell later on this afternoon. Our roadmap begins with the return of sell-off mode. Markets struggle to sustain that comeback following those weeks of losses.
Plus, Snap struggles, sending the shares sharply lower. The company warning the economy, quote, deteriorated further and faster than anticipated. We also got some retail headwinds this morning. Best Buy lowers its outlook as it says macro conditions, heard that before, have worsened, Carl.
David, we'll start with the market volatility, of course, after yesterday's rally. We're going to give some, not all, and the guidance cuts we mentioned, Mike, are being somewhat offset by the positive comments from Zoom, Honeywell, and some others today as well.
And I think also just the fact that every single company disappointing or guiding down has already been punished. In other words, we've traveled a certain distance along this path of downgrading what growth is going to look like. The recession talk, the idea that we're kind of shifting away from goods to services, and you know, the unknown story of the digital ad piece. Really interested to see how Meta trades off this. Obviously gapping lower, but maybe it gathers itself and people think like it's more of a Snap issue than a broad digital advertising slowdown. But you know, you have this undisprovable idea that maybe there's a recession not too far in the future and the Fed's going to over tighten and the rest of it. And so when that's going to just not be disputable in any persuasive way, we're going to have to, you know, deal with a lot of this along the way. The Snap thing also brings up, and this has not been too far from us, we're shadowed by the year 2000 NASDAQ meltdown that lasted 2.5 years, and that you went in waves. First, it was a valuation story, and then the fundamentals fell away, and the stocks chased, you know, the valuation compression and the earnings, and it became this, well, tech is tightening its belt, and tech basically is other tech revenues, is spending by one company, is there, there's revenue. And I'm not saying we're there, but that's why I think you have the hair trigger.
Right. As you can see right there, Snap's going to open sharply lower, David. I mean, it is interesting. They did give us a print on April 21st, and at the time they said that their commentary was probably conservative. But now macro's deteriorated further and faster than we expected. Others point out, you know, revenue less than $6 billion this year. It's not the bellwether that you would associate with, say, a J.P. Morgan, which we got yesterday, with much different color.
It's true. There are a lot of different cross currents, to your point, Carl. I mean, yesterday you hear from Jamie Dimon, who was seen as being somewhat positive, right? You know, and there you see J.P. Morgan talking about Snap as well in terms of what they're seeing. As you said, it was only a month ago, and that is taking people perhaps by some surprise. That said, when you look back at the CFO's comments from the April 21st earnings call, I mean, he did say forward-looking visibility is as difficult today or perhaps more difficult than at any point in recent memory. And again, this was only 1 month ago. And also said they were concerned the operating environment ahead could be even more challenging, leading to further campaign pauses or advertising budget reductions. Both of which, of course, have occurred as a result of what they, or at least what they said, are these sort of macro conditions that are buffeting or hurting headwinds for the business. You know, Mike, I do come back to you on this idea as to how much this is going to impact shares of, and there they are, Meta and Alphabet, Twitter, which has got its own special situation, to say the least, and Pinterest. Right now, the market does seem to be taking it more broadly. And perhaps should. I mean, it's not like we didn't, you know, see Walmart and Target not come in where we expected. There are questions. Will they pause advertising in some sort of meaningful way? Marriott saying some things to Andrew. You know, I don't know, Mike, how to read it at this point, but I think the first reaction is going to simply be to sell. There's plenty of people who piled into Snap after that earning, after the earnings on April 21st, in part because they thought it was cheap there, given the growth rate of the company. The stock had fallen from 40 to 23 already. Obviously, a lot more downside that they were unaware of as little as a month later.
Sure. And there's no doubt that initially it's going to be a dampening effect on anybody dependent on the digital ad pipeline. I mean, Trade Desk, right? That's the play on, you know, digital ad platform, essentially. That's going to be down 10% this morning. So I'm not saying that that's irrational or that that's not something that maybe we're going to have to deal with for a while. It's more about where it settles out. You know, look at the lows for Meta over this period. You know, it's not at the open going to challenge those lows, right? So the 52-week low in Meta is, you know, what is it, in the, you know, 170s or something? It's clearly not necessarily going to be the place it's going to go the way of Snap. And I do think there's another piece of this, which is, have we ever been sure that Snap was a good business? Necessarily, in the moment, I mean, maybe someday, and it's a great product, and it had an audience everybody wanted that now TikTok has a lot of. But $7 billion in losses over 5 years. The share count's up by a third in 5 years because they hand out the equity to employees. So I think there's some exacerbating issues with Snap that's a little more than, oh no, the digital ad pie is not growing as fast as we thought.
That's interesting. Morgan Stanley had a chart yesterday of companies where stock-based comp is underwater.
Yeah.
Snap's on the list. I think about maybe 9%, but nowhere near the likes of, say, a Stitch Fix or a Peloton or a Lyft even. Pretty interesting, but that's going to raise the prospect of having to pay in cash from here on out.
And it's an overhang. It also echoes the 2000 to 2002 story. Back then, it was about we were going to reprice option strikes lower and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah.
As for the go ahead, David. Sorry.
No, I mean, I think that's an interesting point, guys. You know, and I've been hearing anecdotally about other companies. I mean, you think of Netflix, for example, that has seen such an incredible fall in its stock. Many employees there are well compensated with cash, but certainly also expected that their stock compensation would grow dramatically. That has been the exact opposite for shares of Netflix. And it does lead to people looking for other jobs, which I've been hearing about as well. You know, when you're watching what you expected was your nest egg down as much as 60-65% or more in a year, Carl, it can motivate you to look elsewhere, perhaps, for something that may not have as large a stock component when it comes to your overall compensation.
Yeah. Goldman had a piece yesterday talking about large consumer companies that referenced the labor market in the last couple of months that counted 60 overall. About a third of them noted better labor supply, better labor availability. And so Goldman says they think wage growth could go from 5.5 to 4.5 at the end of the year as we get a little more people looking for jobs, to David's point. As for the broader market, a lot of discussion today about the tone in Davos, how pessimistic it is. You had David Rubenstein yesterday say recession may not be that far away from where we are unless the Russian-Ukraine conflict ends quickly. And then Ray Dalio today talking about how the Fed and individuals, just about everybody, is a seller of something. Take a listen.
Federal Reserve is going to sell. Individuals are selling. Foreigners are selling. And the U.S. government is selling because it has to fund its deficit. So there's going to be a supply-demand problem. That means that it produces a squeeze.
So big macro thoughts from Dalio. We know sort of his worldview.
Yes, very focused on the big structural flows and what the Fed is doing and whether, in fact, you know, you're going to have the offsets. Is the Fed shrinking its balance sheet really selling? Is the fact that the U.S. deficit has been shrinking and therefore reducing net issuance of treasuries not an issue here? So I look, this very good articulation of the macro stance, I think, by the big kind of systematic, we follow the trends, macro folks, that's been in place. The point about individual selling is, I think, a very salient one, which is if you look at how people are positioned in equities, everybody is cut back really toward below normal exposures, probably hedge funds, you know, fund manager cash, except for households. Households still have a high equity exposure. They hate bonds more than they're scared of stocks. That's been the rule. The outflows from bonds until very recently have been pretty severe. So is that another shoe to drop? That's the question. I think Goldman's been asking, other firms have been asking that. But you know what? market being down 20% takes care of that. It takes care of the equity exposure over time. So we'll see.
David, you've spent a good amount of time talking about positioning, at least in hedge funds. I must say, insider buying, which we have ignored in the past at our own peril, continues to add to the list. Yesterday, it was Avis. First time since March 2020, where you now have buying on the insiders exceeding selling. That's going to be something to watch.
Yeah, that's a positive sign, Carl. You know, but it is when I speak to asset managers, many of them are just frankly confused, more so than I think they've been in a long time, given just so many of the cross currents, even in the conversation we've just had for the last 10 minutes. How things play out from here. This is a somewhat different environment. You know, yesterday, Jamie Dimon, even at the investor day for JP Morgan, pointing to it a bit in terms of a strong economy and the consumer in good shape, but then talking about big storm clouds as well, but they may dissipate. You know, we say it over and over again, but it is seemingly unpredictable time right now with inflation so high, the Fed raising rates, and yet, Mike, again, and I said this to you yesterday, everybody wants to talk about a recession. Every conversation now ends with, are we in a recession? Which I still am finding a little difficult to imagine things have changed that quickly, but perhaps they have. If we do enter a recession, though, with high inflation, it's not clear exactly where the Fed's going to be able to sort of do in terms of its real flexibility.
Well, that's exactly the issue. It's not so much that, we have this slowdown. It's later in the cycle. You know, the Fed is tightening. We know how this goes. It's the perception that there's not really an easy exit from that situation if, in fact, inflation remains high. And you can't look to the market and say, you know, the market's sniffing it out. The market's going to sniff it out if inflation goes down, because we have no confidence in that at this point, simply because we've been proven wrong about transitory inflation and all the rest. So I do think that makes a lot of sense. But also, it's been manifesting itself in a pretty dramatic way price-wise because of where we started in valuations and because of where we started, where the excesses had kind of built up. And so that process underway of just the standard, okay, you can't pay as much for every dollar of earnings when the Fed's doing this and rates are up, combines with we might be kind of using up this expansion more quickly than we thought.
Right.
And I don't think the evidence is there. If you look at the really concrete leading indicators of recession, they're not in place yet. It's the market kind of always over anticipating and expecting that you're gonna actually feel it before it's in front of
that
you.
That was JP Morgan's point yesterday,
yeah,
that the model using financial indicators way ahead of the macroeconomic indicators in terms of what they say is often a false positive.
That's right. And it happens along the way. It happened in, you know, arguably it happened in 2018 and arguably happened in 98, arguably happened in 2011, right? You sort of thought that you were on a knife's edge. What's interesting this time is nominal growth because of inflation is not going to be negative. And so corporate top line maybe doesn't suffer that much. And also the final piece is this: the S&P 500 is most of it selling stuff as opposed to services.
Right.
And that's in the crosshairs right now. Just the way the S&P overachieved coming out of the bottom, it's a headwind now.
Yeah. Take a look at futures here. We'll get to some of the other names. It's going to be a busy week for retail, as you know, and we will get to what Best Buy said. A&F is in there, Ralph Lauren, Chewy, and of course Zoom. A lot more Squawk on the Street is straight ahead.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system up to a 313-mile range and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Wouldn't it be great to have all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, makes it easy. I use it to put my investment account and 401k accounts into one hub and get expert tips that help me confidently manage my money. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
We are on track for a lower open following that big rally to start the week. Joining us this morning, Oppenheimer Asset Management Chief Investment Strategist John Stolfus and Allspring Global Investments Senior Portfolio Manager Margi Patel. Great to see both of you guys. Margi, your point late last week was that forward guidance is working in terms of the tightening of conditions and the markets baking that in well ahead of what Fed funds itself has to do.
Yes, that's right. The Fed has talked a very tough game, and I think maybe they hoped that the market would do their work for them. They wouldn't have to raise rates so quickly or so often. But I think the market has gone a little ahead of itself, and now people are genuinely fearful of all the Fed's talk about continuing to raise aggressive liquidation, raising funds rate by a point, and they really have scared the market to death. And if they would pursue on that path, I think, in fact, you would have the beginnings of the recession late this year or in 23.
So what parts of the market do you think have overcorrected into the value side?
Well, I think there's been a lot of overcorrection, but I think there are two parts of the market. Price-earnings ratios for the whole market has come down maybe four or five turns, but those specific sectors that did so well during the growth phase, that is small tech, small biotech, small tech with no earnings, the SPACs, the most speculative parts of the market that did so well are collapsing, not because of rates going up, but simply because people are looking at the fundamentals and saying these companies simply don't have the fundamentals we thought. So those are the sectors that have really gotten pounded. I don't think they're coming back. I think it's all the rest of the market that's got value price, and that's where we're looking to find the most attractive places.
John, how should we think about the earnings outlook? Because we were talking about how valuations have certainly come back toward the neutral zone, but that depends on earnings coming through in the second half. And obviously, we're getting some of these consumer companies downscaling what they expect. So where do you think we're going to land there?
I think we'll probably land a lot better than what people think, Mike, just as in this last quarter. You know, for Q1, people don't even talk about Q1. And earnings in technology were up 10%, as I recall, on back of revenue growth of about 12%. And that's with the vast majority of companies having reported. And across other sectors, my recollection is off of the top of my head that nine sectors are reporting positive earnings, and all sectors, and some, mind you, very little, I think of communication services, reporting a positive revenue growth. So I think, just like you said a minute ago, I think we got to look at revenue growth. It's a good forward indicator. And where we are right now, whenever the Fed is in the start of a Fed funds hike cycle, people get out of line with projecting negative things. Whether you go back to 2009, which was a recovery period parallel to this, or whether you go back to 1994 and things worked out.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt things worked out. I do think, though, that, you know, maybe the market is telling us that it has to get too cheap as opposed to just fair, John. If you look back at where we bottomed, you had the 2018 sell-off in early 2016, you did seem to build in a little more of a valuation cushion. So do you think that we might overshoot in that direction?
Well, yeah, I think we likely will, although, you know, the forward handle on the S&P as of last Friday was 16 and change, and I think it was headed towards 15 at one point. We've got to consider that the forward valuation has come down, and not just on the S&P, but if you look at the mid caps, the S&P 400, the S&P 600, which is a higher quality, and even the Russell 2000. The multiples have been coming down at levels that are going to be regarded as very attractive, we'd have to think.
Hey, Margi, in terms of global growth, I wonder what you think of the risk of defaults in emerging market debt, things, dislocations that can happen with the market's legs a little bit wobbly, not necessarily recessionary, but definitely weaker than before.
Yes. Well, what's interesting about this cycle is, one, we're entering this fearful period at a time where the U.S. economy is very well balanced. We don't really have any sectors that are worrying, unlike other parts of the world. Emerging markets are loaded with debt, mostly highly dependent on China. China's growth has slowed down. And in fact, I believe that thanks to COVID and some other things, our growth is actually going to be exceeding China's growth, showing you the strength of the economy. And really around the world, there's so much going on, most of it negative. That says to me that there's a lot more risk as far as earnings disappointment and economic growth, and the risk of defaults, which we've already started to see pop up in the emerging markets. Makes the U.S. look pretty good.
Yeah, it's definitely a good time to have your radar beyond the borders of the U.S. And overseas as well. John Marghi, thanks for getting us started on this Tuesday. We'll see you next time. In the meantime, take a look at futures here. Still in the red, I think off the worst levels of the morning. Squawk on the Street continues in the opening bell in less than 10 minutes.
1 in 8. That's how many people have worked at a McDonald's. Who serve millions the best Big Mac and best birthday party they've ever had. Who haven't just seen kids graduate from a Happy Meal, but have gotten help graduating themselves. Because they know the skills learned here.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to English Under the Arches.
Can help you grow from here or keep growing here.
Hi,
1 in 8, start at McDonald's. And where you start stays with you.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
This morning, we are remembering our good friend Mark Haynes, who passed away 11 years ago today. Mark was the founding anchor of Squawk Box, a co-anchor of Squawk on the Street. We remember Mark for his knowledge and wit, for being a champion of the small investor, and, of course, his steady hand during the dot-com bubble, 9/11, and the financial crisis. Speaking of that crisis, remember Mark called that stock market bottom of 2009. We still affectionately call it the Haynes bottom. Our thoughts are with Mark's wife, Cindy, his son, Matthew, and his daughter, Meredith, on this day.
Zoom shares are up in the pre-market off of the session highs. The company did post better than expected quarterly earnings and is raising its profit outlook. Zoom has been shifting its emphasis to products aimed at the hybrid workplace amid waning demand for its video conferencing services as people return to the office. A lot of discussion before the print yesterday, Mike, a name that was once 25 times sales, now five times sales, but with a good cash hoard and maybe a good example of how you pivot post-COVID.
Went from 25 times sales to 22 times forward earnings. You go down 80% in price, and that's how it is. It's now kind of just a normal company, right? Sales expected to grow next year 10 to 12%. It's a blocking and tackling business, and yes, you know, with some kind of ability to expand and reinvent along the way. It loses the buzz, but it has a much more sort of tangible place, I think, in the tech universe.
Right. Will be important in the ongoing conversation about the future of hybrid work, the future of IT budgets, how they consolidate their vendors, how they demand their workers to come in or not. Right. That's the whole point.
100%. And you know, David, the question with these things always is, you know, do the big companies just essentially absorb that type of function, right? I mean, is Microsoft not going to be sitting there and saying, oh, Zoom can have its niche? So I think a much more sort of familiar story based on kind of past tech evolution cycles.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, those numbers, by the way, were great, Mike. 25 times revenues to 22 times earnings sort of puts in perspective what's happened to many of these stocks. And of course, we see it with Zoom, which once had a more than $100 billion market value. But Carl, back to the office. I mean, they're saying people are returning to the office. I don't know. I'm not seeing that much evidence of it yet. We seem to be stuck at somewhere around 40% perhaps on any given day. And here we are, how many years into this thing? 2 years and 3 months, I guess, at this point. You know, they keep calling it the new normal. It's just the normal at this point. Hybrid work is the normal. I can certainly say that as well, being here back in our EC headquarters. You know, don't look for a lot of people around because they won't be here.
No, I think that's right. I mean, obviously, there are some, you know, regional variations in that, I could say. If you're in the middle of the country, it's a different story. But also the question is, doesn't everybody have the Zoom subscription? So it's more just like, well, people aren't going to get rid of it. It's not clear that that means a lot of future growth based on hybrid work.
Yeah. I keep thinking what Ken Griffin said last week. Having everybody back together has been really powerful in driving forward our business. It's nice to be in a room and not have to deal with 25 different distractions. We'll see. We'll see whether or not safety overrides the labor cycle, if in fact the labor cycle really makes a turn. Let's get the opening bell here and the CNBC real-time exchange. And the big board, it's Nicolet Bankshares, based in Wisconsin, celebrating its transfer from the NASDAQ, and at the NASDAQ multimedia company Avid Technology, marking its annual investor day. We haven't yet gotten to Best Buy, really, Mike. The first miss in about 5 years. Revenues were ahead. Comps down 8.5. We were looking for 9.4. And they do cut their guide. Actually, it was trading good in the pre-market,
yes,
which some said was
it's green. Yeah. I mean, it's up 0.5% at the open. I just think that, you know, it's down almost 20% month to date before this. So, you know, right after the Target Walmart announcements, people really sort of took flight from a lot of the larger retailers. And we also did know that most of the pain, while yes, people are worried about durable goods, high-end, you know, hard goods like Best Buy sales, the real pain is in clothing, in terms of what people are worried about in terms of the overhang and the discounting. So it seemed like a reasonable outlook, at least at the outset. Super cheap looking stock, if you believe that, you know, the cash flows hold up. You know, it's cheap on par with, you know, the Kohl's and the Gaps of the world, where they're priced for you know, longer term decline. So maybe that explains why it's able to get up there a couple of percent after really being cut in half from the highs, Best Buy.
Yeah. They say, David, our guide would not assume a full recession at this point. And obviously, if that were the case, we'll continue to update. Expectations, I think, would characterize our guide more as a softer environment, not a full recession. But speaking of inventories, I don't know if you've seen some of these inventory numbers. At Abercrombie, yeah, up 44. You remember Target was up 43. Walmart was up 24. Kohl's was up 40. So if you're looking for signs of disinflation, at the very least,
absolutely,
you might turn to apparel.
You have the makings of disinflation. And, of course, 6 months ago it was, boy, you want to be one of the big box stores because they can get the product.
Right.
They're the ones who are going to be able to cut through a lot of the shipping friction, David, and essentially,
yeah,
at least have enough, and now they have too much.
You know, I do wonder, Mike, well, you know, was there any, and I don't know, I've heard this anecdotally, was there over-ordering in part to make sure, given the supply chain constraints, that you had enough product? And so was there, you know, more ordering that might have even been deemed appropriate given the current demand that we saw? And obviously now they've got a lot more product on hand, perhaps because of that, because you just didn't know how much you were going to be able to get because,
right,
the supply chain was so unpredictable.
No, I think that's exactly right. And all the chains were focused on get as much as possible. They were operating on the premise that we have this rare window where markdowns are not a thing and people are accepting full price. And so there wasn't maybe perceived as much of a risk to having too much inventory. And, you know, here's where we sit. And, you know, I guess there was, you know, at some point pent up demand for clothing, right? People thought the back to office thing was going to be a thing. And
yeah,
I don't know. I'm sure it goes chain by chain in terms of what the missteps might have been. But combined with an overall slowdown and gas prices doing what they're doing, which, if nothing else, you know, depletes what you can spend on other things.
There's Corey Barry, of course, talking about those trends in the second quarter. And their expectations. But Best Buy doing okay, certainly versus the likes of Snap. Let's take a look. We talked about it at the top of the show. The company, of course, surprising many when yesterday, during the J.P. Morgan conference and then following up with an 8-K filing, it says it's likely revenue EBITDA will come in below the low end of our guidance range. The macroeconomic environment has definitely deteriorated further and faster than we expected when we issued our guidance for the second quarter. By the way, that was only on the 21st of April. And you can see what that is doing to shares of Snap, down another 36%. As I said earlier, the stock did not perform particularly well after those quarterly numbers. And in fact, some saw as an opportunity, you can look back in April, to sort of pick it up in the mid-20s. given what appeared to be a fairly decent earnings multiple. Back to sort of what you were talking about, Mike, these companies that had traded at multiples to sales that were in the well into the double digits falling significantly, so much so that their earnings actually were more in the, let's call it, multiple of the 20s or something like that. Not good enough there, though. And again, we do find ourselves wondering, well, what exactly did change in such a short amount of time in terms of that macroeconomic environment that they are citing, whether it's supply chain, whether it's just inflation, Ukraine, and other things as well, interest rates also.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, all those things that affect their customers, the unknown piece is when there's a little bit of belt tightening and when the advertisers are looking to, I guess, prioritize where they really want to focus their spending, you know, is Snap a little bit on the outside, or they're getting less than their share. And of course, they still have the overhang of the Apple privacy changes and things like that. I did mention, you know, take a look at how Meta does trade, you know, just for benchmarking sake. And it closed under 175 Meta before they had the earnings. They had a little bit of a relief trade, a big relief trade up toward earnings. And so we haven't gotten back down there and see if it tries to get some traction above its own lows. Of course, a very different story because it's down so much already, but also has that very large earnings base that has attracted a lot of value investors. Carl, unlike the past.
Yeah, we're going to watch social media for sure, and we've mentioned the potential effect on Twitter. Of course, shareholder meeting coming up. Webbush last night says 54.20, Dan Ives says, is out the window. Currently a 60% chance in Dan's view that Musk tries to walk and use this spam account issue as the scapegoat. With Snap's disaster quarter warning, accepting a lower bid price would be a much better alternative for the board, Webbush argues.
Yeah.
As for Tesla, a couple of interesting things, David. One is Cathie Wood bought 16,000 shares of Tesla, first time since February. And then Bernstein, Tony Saganaki comes out and says that a fall to 400 on Tesla would require Musk to sell about 13 million shares. So we continue to watch his risk here as he tries to buy this company.
Yeah, respectfully, many would disagree with Dan Ives. They would go back to the contract, which is very straightforward and requires Mr. Musk to buy this company at 54.20 and does not have a lot of outs and has specific performance on the equity. And it would have to be fraud on the part of Twitter, essentially, knowing that, in fact, they were misstating the number of bot accounts or fake accounts on the platform. Could be very difficult for him to prove that. But again, nothing says that if you're Twitter, you don't say, all right, we'll give you a little bit of a discount if you will give us a far larger reverse break fee and promise, you know, and no way or how are you ever getting out of it from here. But man, that is one enormous spread. But of course, also perhaps being pressured as well in the fundamentals as a result of what we've been talking about with Snap. Guys, Pinterest also down 20%. In the control book, can we put up a 3-year of Pinterest? Because, that gives you a look at Twitter and Tesla in terms of, by the way, great sales there by Musk when he did sell at the 900 range, at least as much as $6 billion in stock to help pay for Twitter. There's Pinterest. Look at that. Mike, it's at this point, it's a total, almost a total round trip from where it was, over a 3-year period. Actually, does that say down 30%? Yeah, but just gives you some sense as to what's happened to so many of these one-time multiple companies. Of course, remember briefly, PayPal seemed to be interested in buying it, although it was never clear exactly what was going on there.
Exactly, and that's one of those little spikes on the way down was that PayPal news. It's remarkable. And to your point about Twitter, I mean, if you think about how this spread is arrived at, it's essentially some probability that the deal gets done as it is meant to at 54.20. Then applying that probability to where you think that stock would trade if there were no deal. And so that assumed level that Twitter would trade at, absent a deal, probably has gone down a lot. It doesn't account for the whole spread, which is over 40% upside right now from where Twitter is trading. But it is a dynamic story, also related to just the willingness of arbitrageurs to really step in and make that bet, underwrite that probability.
David, yeah. I know you like to watch Bilson over at Gordon Haskett. He says Snap's problem is Musk's problem. Now, we've heard people say Musk plays hardball, and he might get an adjustment like the one LVMH got at Tiffany. But that was a 2.6% haircut. Mm-hmm. Musk doesn't need one of those or even five of those. 10 Tiffany's is more like it. None of this will make it easier for Musk to draw in more investors or keep the ones that were early recruits.
No, all true. Don's very good and always enjoy reading his stuff, which is usually dead on. Yeah, listen, Twitter's fascinating, continues to be. And again, that spread is enormous, as Mike just pointed out, for any number of reasons. But it is going to be a real test. Still waiting for them to sue him. That's the one question I keep asking. Why haven't they as yet just sort of started the war?
Just on that point, what specific landmark or, responsibility that Musk has to deliver something, absent just, finally closing the deal, would be the trigger for them to say, we have to sue you to adhere to the deal?
Well, reasonable best efforts. I would argue he's not making them right now. Tweeting constantly and questioning whether there's fraud at a company that you're buying doesn't appear to be your reasonable best efforts to get the deal done. So he's in breach right there, you could argue.
Yeah.
Guys, speaking of arbitrage, let's get to, obviously we talked about it a lot yesterday, Broadcom and VMware. I told you yesterday, Thursday was the day they had previously been focused on as a deal announcement. That appears to still be the case. Yesterday, I think it was the Journal or Dow Jones reporting roughly 140 a share. That is, from what I'm hearing, correct as well. And again, it's roughly, it could be a bit more, a bit less. But part of it will depend on the performance of Broadcom stock, because I can also tell you that it is roughly a 50-50 cash stock deal. So that will give people at least some sense here in terms of what we're talking about. Again, 50-50 cash and stock, and that is new in terms of at least what people want to understand. Maybe we want to actually show them that at the bottom of the screen as well. Another question, of course, if they do announce this deal, will be whether, in fact, and how long it takes to get antitrust approval. You're going to need China. You're going to need CFIUS. That should not be an issue here. But remember, of course, some people still remember well that that Hock Tan was not successful in buying Qualcomm, in part because Treasury stepped in and said no, and that was CFIUS. That doesn't appear to be in play here, but China certainly will be important. U.S., you never know. It wouldn't seem to be an issue, perhaps, in infrastructure, software, but nonetheless certainly could take at least, if not more than a year, to get any deal done. But again, roughly 140, roughly 50-50 cash stock split. Carl.
All right, guys. Before we go to break, let's take a look at the bond report. As we said, we're going to hear from Powell around 2:20 East Coast time. I think the remarks are pre-recorded, but something to keep in mind, obviously, ahead of the Fed minutes, which come out tomorrow. You got the VIX still sub 30, 10-year cooling off below 279. I'll keep an eye on that with the Dow down 163.
Welcome back to Squawk on the Street. Rick Santelli here with breaking news. Our May preliminary read on S&P Global PMIs for the manufacturing headline, expecting 57.7, darn close, 57.5. And if we look at the services, 53.5, lighter than expected, sequentially following 55.6. And it is the weakest, well, since January when we were at 51.2. And finally, the composite, 53.8, well below the 55.7 expected. Sequentially, it follows 56, and it is also the lightest since January at 51.1. These are a bit of a disappointment. New home sales at top of the hour. Squawk on the Street will return in 2 minutes.
I am planting this weekend, so do not bother me.
Okay.
All right. I know you want to bother me. I am putting in my tomato plants, so stop it.
All right, I'll leave you alone.
We'll be looking for pictures, Jim.
Oh, yeah. Mezcal and tomato plants.
Always in a suit. Man gardens with a tie.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to garden in a Brioni just for you. Okay?
150
okay.
Count.
Okay. Yeah, this is an Hermes gardening tie.
That's Jim at the end of Friday's show outlining his gardening plans for his time off. He did follow through, as seen in his tweet from yesterday, saying, quote, "When I garden, I always go Brioni." And I replied to him, David, he's a man of his word.
He is, although I wanted to see him like down on his knees with his hands in the ground. And I wanted to see that Brioni suit have some dirt on it. You know, that was like he was, here's my garden. I'm in my suit. Right? I don't know. I don't know, Carl. Like, is that really what I was looking for? I don't know.
Exactly. There was a stock point to this, Mike, and that was late spring for Depot had some effect on some of these April quarters.
Well, no doubt about it. And, you know, it's great that he's getting it in there because a lot of the country in ag land, they haven't gotten enough planted because of weather. But it also gives new meaning to that whole, you know, what am I, a farmer? When somebody says, why are you so dressed up? So he does both, I guess.
That was from 30 Rock. That was
there you go.
I remember
Jack
that line.
Donaghy.
He was in a tuxedo. He said, yeah, Lemon, what am I, a farmer? All right, let's move on. CNBC's continuing its coverage of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. And Sarah Eisen joins us now, and she's got a lot more for us. Sarah.
Hi, good morning, David, Carl, and Mike. Just wanted to share some color from the ground here where talks are underway from the world's top policymakers and CEOs from around the globe. You know, there's a lot of discussion about the market here, and as you guys are talking about, and what the stock market is telling us about whether the U.S. is going into recession, about how much the global economy is going to slow. I just wanted to share a little bit with you from a panel that I moderated just a few moments ago here as part of the World Economic Forum, which hosts panels all day long, because the topic was, are the markets disconnected from reality? And there were some interesting comments and some actionable ideas that came from it. Katie Koch, who is the CIO of Goldman Sachs Asset Management, actually says that there's a great long-term opportunity in some parts of technology. She mentioned biotech, for instance, which has sharply underperformed. She mentioned software and cybersecurity. And she also said that some of the warnings we're getting right now at corporate America, we're talking about the SNAP warning that I'm sure you guys are here in Davos, on top of what we got from Target and Walmart and Ross stores, are potentially worrisome signs that the U.S. is getting closer than previously thought by investors to some sort of slowdown. Also, want to bring you some interesting color from Ahmed Al-Hamadi. He is a CIO at the Qatar Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is part of the conversation. We don't get to talk to the sovereign wealth funds very much, so it's always interesting. They move a lot of money around. He's particularly engaged in the private markets and investing in private companies, where he says, David, there are a lot of down rounds now and that they are starting to reflect more of the reality, for instance, that we're getting in the public market. There was a little disagreement on the panel about that, whether private markets are sort of as negative as what we're seeing in the public markets. But he's suggesting that you're going to see down rounds and may even see a lot less fundraising activity going forward. So clearly the discussion is about the changing economic fundamentals and how that's being reflected in the markets. But I wouldn't say it's too doomy and gloomy, not too pessimistic. And maybe that's just because leaders by nature are usually more optimistic. We'll talk to one in the next hour of Squawk on the Street. Sanjay Mehrotra joins us. He's the CEO of Micron, which is right in the heart of supply chain issues, questions about demand, and of course, geopolitical issues, everything from Taiwan to Russia to China. Carl, so I'll see you next hour for that interview.
Fascinating. There's been really good color out of Davos this year in particular. It's nice to have everybody back there, Sarah. We'll see you in a bit. Markets holding in. Dow's down 130 despite some of the retail blowups. Let's get to Bob Pisani. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, guys. Two steps forward, one step backward for the S&P 500. Want to take a look at some of the sectors right now at the open, because Meta is really weighing on the overall S&P right now. Semiconductors are also notably weak. So some of the big cap tech names are weak. Retail, of course, are weak. So there's your two weakest sectors right now. And of course, the market's got a defensive tone somewhat. Healthcare doing better. Consumer staples a little better. Hershey's, General Mills, Procter & Gamble, a little more stable, but only fractionally here. In terms of big cap tech, I just want to note, it looks like Meta is the biggest decliner on the S&P 500 right now, and that obviously related to the Snap news. But Google and big cap semis like NVIDIA, Micron are also notably weaker here. David mentioned Corey Barry's comments, the Best Buy CEO, but I just want to put it up because I think it reflects overall sentiment and the concern that April saw some notable deterioration. Macro conditions worsened since we provided our guidance in early March, which resulted in our sales being slightly lower than expectations. Those trends have continued into the second quarter, and as a result, we're revising our sales and profitability expectations for the year. However, on the conference call, she was asked about recession chances and sort of clarified what they were saying here. She said, it's fair to say that we are factoring in elements of softer demand, but we are not planning for a full recession. I think an important clarification for them. But you know, regardless here, these companies, it seems like the April companies with the April ending quarter are reporting some deterioration demand, particularly on the retail side. So if you want a retail trend here, the two that seem clear to me is we saw some deterioration in April, whether you want to call it climate issues for some people or inflation issues for some people or demand issues, whatever. There was some deterioration, and earnings estimates for retailers are starting to come down. Consumer discretionary is one of the few groups where earnings estimates are actually coming down. I've been annoyed about this for weeks now, about the earnings estimates not going down, but they are for the retail area. In terms of what to watch for, Nordstrom's going to be reporting. I would watch Costco. That's going to be the big one. That'll be on Thursday at the close. Remember, this company is the classic big subscription model out there. Their multiple has gone down dramatically from about 45 to 32 in a month. So there's multiple compression. But this is the classic earnings growth company. Steady, great quality earnings growth consistently. Any problems here is going to be a big, big surprise. As I said, there's been multiple compression, but earnings estimates not coming down. We'll keep an eye on that one. I think the social media story, I mean, that's another little leg to this idea that April saw some deterioration and not just in retail here. Snap seems to have seen a major global macro deteriorations. Not just the costs are up, but even advertising may be being cut there. So this is this whole idea that April saw some kind of deterioration. In terms of the big three that's moving markets, there's nothing really new on the horizon right now that's changing the overall narrative. The Fed inflation are still three big issues, Fed inflation, Russia, Ukraine, and COVID lockdown in China. Carl, I'd watch, at least everyone's messaging me, for these big three issues, it's the PCE on Friday. We need signs inflation is not stabilizing, but slowly moving to a downtrend. This is going to be a long, drawn-out process, but PCE will be the big economic number this week. That'll be on Friday. Carl, back to you.
All right, Bob. Yeah, we do have some good prints coming up. Bob Pisani, thanks. When we come back, as Sarah said, her interview with Micron's Sanjay Mehrotra from Davos. Dow down 168. You do have Apple below 140 again. And the 10-year close to a one-month low on the yield, lowest since April 27th.
You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.